and my fellow Pennsylvanians.
This state's electoral votes are key to who wins the presidency, and both of the candidates know it.
We win Pennsylvania, we win the whole deal. You know that. Just like last time.
But states like Pennsylvania are going to be incredibly important.
The only thing left on the board is Pennsylvania. The president cannot get to the finish line without the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
One state all four candidates are visiting today is Pennsylvania. Its 20 electoral votes are highly coveted, and the Keystone State could end up being one of the determining factors in the race.
Jill's a Philly girl, but I'm a Scranton girl.
We're less than 3 weeks away from arguably the most consequential primary in Pennsylvania history. Today, we're going to have both a broad and granular conversation about Allegheny County. This is Pennsylvania's second largest, with very diverse townships and boroughs, in addition to the iconic neighborhoods across the city of Pittsburgh. There are two open congressional seats. Two of the D Senate candidates call the county their home and are counting on a strong turnout. Our guest is Erin McClelland. She knows every corner of the county, and next year she hopes to be the county executive. She's organized campaigns, and she's also run for office herself. I also particularly appreciate Erin's perspective on the important role of organized labor over the years in Allegheny County. I'm looking forward to unpackaging these contentious congressional primaries and more with Erin. Erin McClelland, welcome to my kitchen table.
Thank you, Ari. Great to be here.
Erin, I am excited because we are less than 3 weeks out from probably the most contentious primary season that Democrats have had in Pennsylvania in a while. We're going to spend some time really dissecting the two races that are happening in your home county, Allegheny County. And then also, I'm sure that folks would be eager to hear about your perspective on the Senate race because two of the candidates are from Allegheny County. But first things first, give folks a little sense of your background, Erin.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me. So I am born and raised in Allegheny County in Western Pennsylvania, but not in the city of Pittsburgh. I'm part of the 1.2 million people that live in Allegheny. I'm part of the 900,000 that don't live in the city. My career history started in drug and alcohol and ended up running a drug and alcohol program. Did that for 20 years, working on the opiate addiction. And that actually led me to work on a project with former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. Mr. O'Neill did a lot of work on healthcare, particularly error resolution and reduction of medical errors. And that really was spun out of work that he'd done at the Treasury and looking at healthcare costs and realizing that medical error and hospital acquired infection was such a huge part of the growth in costs for medical care. So when I was working with him on the addiction end and learning about what he was doing, and I'd always had a passion for politics and for policy. And I come from a really strong union background, but working with Mr. O'Neill kind of forced me to take my policy chops to the next level. And we really got involved in some of that work here in Western Pennsylvania. And that actually led me to run for the United States Congress against a Tea Party Republican that won in 2010 or after redistricting and got in there, or actually 2012. And he ran on repealing the Affordable Care Act. So with my healthcare background, I was a little offended by that. This was Jack Murtha's old seat, you know, the dawn of the Pennsylvania corner in Congress and the father of the Mirthquake here in Western Pennsylvania. So to see his seat go to a Tea Party Republican was very frustrating. So I ran for that seat. It was a very gerrymandered R11 district, but we ran on a real working class message. And this was in 2014. So you kind of saw the writing on the wall for what was about to happen with Trump. In 14, you could see that working class bleed into the red side, what they refer to at times, the long red thread. You saw that coming to fruition after, you know, 40 some years of free trade. So when I was on the ballot again in 2016 with Trump on the ballot, it was an absolutely surreal experience to go through that process. And then after that, I've run races statewide for a judicial candidate. I ran the Allegheny County District Attorney's primary, a state Senate race. So I've done a lot of races since then, and have just loved every minute of navigating what is happening in Western Pennsylvania, and particularly Allegheny County, as we move forward and try and redefine what the party looks like out here.
So politics is definitely, it sounds like, in your DNA. It's tell me, was that something from your upbringing when you were growing up? You alluded to labor. Were your folks members of organized labor? I mean, at what point did you get the political bug, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, so I actually grew up and still live today in what's called the Allie-Kiske Valley on the Allegheny River. And it remains a working class steel town. We still have an active steel mill. It is a titanium rolling mill, one of the only six in the world. That was renovated years ago to make it more environmentally friendly. So the jobs out of that plant and the retirees that are still there, we have 1,300 steel workers in just the house district that we have where I am. My father was IBEW. My mother was a boilermaker as a registered nurse. And my grandfather was a steel worker at Pullman Standard, which was sort of the gold standard of fighting and solving problems with a baseball bat back in the days. So yeah, that labor history has always been strong and remains strong in my hometown. So that was a lot of where my political came from. And the devastation that you see as a diehard Democrat and watching blue collar and working class workers feel abandoned and be overcome with fear as they are watching jobs run away. See, in my home municipality of Harrison Township, poverty rates going through the roof. Our school district has a 100% free lunch program because the poverty rate is so high. So as you're watching that happen and you're seeing people being affected by this, we're seeing transportation routes being cut. We're losing healthcare providers. We have no mental health providers in that area. So as a Democrat who supports those things, it has been heart-wrenching to see that happen to my area and see what has been such a Democratic stronghold just slowly bleed Democratic voters to the other side. So yeah, that's something I've been passionate about for years, but being on the precipice of what's happening right now as a congressional candidate in 14 and then in 16 and seeing that just astronomical shift in what the world looked like has been unbelievable.
Well, Aaron, we're going to get to the two congressional open seats in a moment, but sure. This is why I was excited to sit down. We have thousands of listeners, many of whom are frankly from the greater Philadelphia area, from Harrisburg, not as many as we would like, honestly, from Allegheny County, but that's changing. So give folks a sense. I think we shouldn't assume that folks know just how diverse, you alluded to the population number, but just how diverse the municipalities of Allegheny County are, because in addition to what you've painted, I mean, some of the most expensive homes and affluent zip codes in the Commonwealth are also in Allegheny County.
Sure. Yeah, there's such a wide culture spectrum of what's happening here in Allegheny County. So I just take the city of Pittsburgh. You have 300,000 people there. We just recently elected our first Black mayor in Mayor Ed Gainey, and he has brought a real change in the perspective of, sort of getting rid of that old boys club mentality that we've had in Allegheny County for so long. Ed Gainey's been a real breath of fresh air. But even in the city, you have like the 31st ward of the city of Pittsburgh that went for Trump. It was the only city ward that did, but you have that one. And then you have the 14th ward, which is stunningly liberal and has this massive population and a very, very high turnout rate. So even within the city, you have the sort of old world working class. I mean, this was a steel town for a very long time, and there's still so much left of that. And I do think that Mayor Gainey really captured that in a way that even fascinated and surprised me in his campaign. It was really wonderful how he talked to people who wanted to move forward and were coming from the progressive end and were speaking to a Black population that definitely feels disenfranchised. But at the same time, he wasn't leaving working class people behind. He was talking about a very inclusive message. And that's what happens in the city. If you have the surrounding areas, which a lot of people forget, that the hills and the valleys of Allegheny County is very working class. You have the Mon Valley Steelworks, massive steel infrastructure, still operating, fighting for its life there, and one of the oldest steel mills in the country. And that's in the Mon Valley. So you have some very conservative working class voters there. You have a very similar infrastructure collapse to that we're seeing in the Allie-Kiske Valley. And then you have the hills. You have like your North Hills, you have Mount Lebanon, you have Slickley in these very wealthy areas. So, and you can literally go from a very wealthy area to a very impoverished area very quickly in Allegheny County. You know, you can literally move one municipality that's neighboring and completely change the income dynamic, the transportation access, the healthcare access. And the farther out of the city you get, the more profound that difference is. Like our house district has Fox Chapel in it, which is an unbelievably wealthy infrastructure. And then you have my school district in it, which is unbelievably poverty stricken, all in the same house district. And you can get from one to the other in 10 minutes. So that's what we're trying to navigate in Allegheny County. And it's a very neighborhood focused infrastructure. So a lot of times it's hard to get people outside their neighborhood and their own political bubble and, you know, see the forest for the trees.
Just to remind listeners, so it's about a year ago that we sat down with the campaign manager for state representative Ed Gainey, now the mayor, who was challenging the incumbent mayor. We also sat down with Bill Peduto's campaign manager and got pretty granular about the city of Pittsburgh. Can you just tell listeners, because I'll be honest, I don't know, the 14th ward and the 31st ward, I think you said. So which neighborhoods are those? Which parts of Pittsburgh?
So when you're looking at the 31st ward, you're looking out by, let's see, I'm trying to think of like Homestead out in that area, you know, Munhall area out there in the more southern part of the city. And then the 14th ward is right there in the East End. So that's where, you know, like Carnegie Mellon, University of Pittsburgh, like sort of out that area.
Got it. So why don't we, since we're getting granular about wards of the city of Pittsburgh, and I think that's what our listeners like and distinguishes this podcast, why don't we plunge into the open race, Congressman Mike Doyle, after such a wonderful career of service to the Commonwealth and the city of Pittsburgh, announced his retirement. And we have a bit of a messy three-way primary. So if you can give folks kind of a sense of that, I know it's an open-ended question, then we'll get more granular.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there, you know, being a federal policy wonk, there's nothing that'll make you want to run for Congress more than Mike Doyle and Jack Murtha. There's no doubt about it. They were amazing, and we love Mike. So actually, what you have is in this race, this open seat, and an unexpectedly open seat. On top of that, you didn't know what it was going to look like because we just went through redistricting. So it's been a very chaotic cycle. You have your top three candidates. That is Summer Lee, who's a state House member right now. You have Steve Irwin, who's been an activist, an advocate in healthcare, and a business person. And then you have Jerry Dickinson, who's a professor. And then you have two other candidates that are sort of hanging on at the bottom here, and that's Jeff Woodard and Willie Parker. So you actually have a five-way race. There was a poll that came out very recently that has 40% undecided. It was an Emily's List poll. Had Summer at 38, Steve Irwin at 13, and Dickinson at 7. So, but it is a dynamic district because you have the city, but it's not just the city. You have the areas in the Mon Valley, working class people who are terrified for their steel mill. And the gripe that they will have against frontrunner Summer Lee is how aggressive she's been on environmental issues. And they have seen that as a threat to their existence. She does not view her messaging that way. And I can see her argument as well. And then you have a part of Westmoreland County. Now, Westmoreland County is an area that was a stronghold for Trump. It was one of the first blue collar counties around Allegheny to really shift to the right. So you have that very conservative area there on top of the Mon Valley and the city of Pittsburgh there. So there's a lot of questions in a five-way race. You know, it's anybody's race. And I think the average person would probably say it's Summers to lose, but not knowing what turnout's going to be like in the Westmoreland County portion, as well as the Mon Valley, and where the votes that aren't for Summer in those areas, because she's extremely progressive, where they go. Do they go to Steve Irwin? Do they go to Jerry Dickinson? Do they go down, you know, further down that ticket?
Sorry, I think it's just important also for listeners. So the Mon Valley refers to the Monongahela River. And give folks just a sense of, I mean, such unique communities that literally built America, but just give folks a little sense of what you're referring to when you're talking about those communities.
We're talking about Clareton Works and Braddock, you know, which obviously John Fetterman has made famous. So like those are the communities that you're working with along the Monongahela River, very similar to the working class communities along the Allegheny.
Got it. It's interesting. We're talking about Westmoreland County with President Trump and Dr. Oz decided to spend some time there. So, and just so listeners know, because there have been so many line changes. So the entire city of Pittsburgh is encompassed in this new congressional district.
Yeah, I don't recall of any parts of it that are in, and I'm still getting familiar with these districts as well. I don't recall.
That makes two of us.
I'm not aware of any parts of the city that are in the PA 17, which is the northern part. There may be something little here and there, but I'm not off the top of my head. Or like I said, I'm still getting used to the exact cut.
Okay, so, you know, from your experience and then what you're seeing, how are these three candidates? They're certainly different shades of Democrat, shall we say. And I'm sorry, I should say five candidates, but they're different shades of the Democratic Party nowadays. Sure. But in terms of how they're running their campaigns, are we seeing more in terms of mail and radio and television or old-fashioned door knocking? I mean, what, you know, have there been debates? You know, give folks a sense.
Yeah, there have been debates. As a matter of fact, I had the pleasure of moderating one for the Pitt Law Democrats, and that was focused on a younger perspective of what the future looks like. I would say that you have Summer Lee, who's just she's a firebrand, just a wonderful firebrand, diehard progressive, very big on criminal justice reform, very big on environmental reform. And she's known for her door knocking and her ground game. Just it's a very classic progressive campaign. And then you have Steve Irwin, who is the older white male. He's running more of an establishment level campaign. Definitely got a ton of money that came in, half of which was from AIPAC. So you have that DC infrastructure raising money from him, and he's running an older campaign. He's actually had some criticism of his campaign. There were some signature issues early on during petitions. There's been some criticism of his legal work. He pushes back on that and says that those characterizations are untrue, but characterizations of the work that he's done against unions. So that's been a little bit of a discussion. And I would say they are obviously your top two front runners. They are the conversation. If you Google an article on this race, those are the two names that you'll see there. Gary Dickinson's campaign is, like I said, polling at about 7%. We haven't seen anything real robust there. For instance, if you wanted to talk about labor union endorsements there, which is always great, you have Steve Irwin, who has the Pittsburgh Building Trades, you know, IBW 5, Ironworkers 3, Boilermakers 154, Steamfitters 449. On the other side, you have Summer Lee, who's getting more of the progressives union, SEIU Healthcare, SEIU 32BJ, the Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers. And then she's bringing Senator Sanders and Senator Warren to the table. Jerry Dickinson went with, he got the Teamsters Tricycle 40 endorsement. So he got one union endorsement compared to the others. So you see, even in fundraising, you see Summer, she's not as much money as Steve, but definitely has a bigger ground game. His cash on hand was, last we checked, 614, where Summer's was 383, and then Jerry's coming up behind at 215. So that's the dynamic of the race you're looking at. Everything has been split along this ideological line, sort of this old world Pittsburgh infrastructure and the new progressive infrastructure. And this is happening all over Western Pennsylvania and Allegheny County. You see races all over the place that are breaking this way with one candidate from each side and battling it out.
Well, I think it's also happening, frankly, across all 50 states. And even on the floor of the U.S. Congress. Tell folks, look, in every race, endorsements mean something different. And, you know, when you mentioned quite a few labor locals, but at the beginning of our conversation, Aaron, you also mentioned how rank and file brothers and sisters in organized labor, they might have voted for Trump once, if not twice. So give folks a sense in these final closing days what these labor endorsements could mean versus what you think that they will actually mean.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the building trades, it definitely means money. Now, remember, we're talking about a congressional race, which means there's an FEC limit of $5,000. And for most of these unions, that money has to come from their international. So there is sort of a second layer of getting money in as far as financial support. And where if you're in a state race, the locals can a lot of times put hundreds of thousands of dollars into a race if they want. When it's federal, they have that $5,000 cap. So you can't get as much financial benefit from a labor union support in a congressional race unless they're going into an IE. So that does limit that. And you basically see Summer and Steve sort of in the same place there on labor money. And your point about what the labor leadership does versus what the rank and file does, that is the big shift that I think we've seen since Trump. You know, when I saw it in 14 and 16, and I saw the amount of steelworkers on the ground that were helping me and out there knocking doors and getting signatures, like that, we've seen a big shift in a separation with rank and file from what their leadership does. And I think a lack of enthusiasm, especially where I live, where there is a massive labor concentration, you just don't see the enthusiasm of rank and file like I did even in, you know, 7 years ago. So that becomes the question. Is these union endorsements used to mean money and muscle? Now, you know, there's money there, but the question is how many boots on the ground, how many voices in the street, how many knuckles on the door? And that's a big question. And I would say we are definitely seeing a deterioration of that in Western Pennsylvania. There's no doubt about
it. Okay, but the bottom line, I think what listeners are hearing is that this is a jump ball, and it's really going to come down to the ground game in the final maybe even hours, certainly days of the race. But this district is drawn in such a way that it's really primary determinative that one of these Democrats is going to be the next member of Congress.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And I will point out that with the amount of money that Steve Irwin does have, which is, you know, probably double, not quite double of what Summer has, the negative ads against Summer have begun. And we've seen her go through this before. She's really proven in the past in her state races to be very Teflon to these accusations and the negative stuff they throw at her. And she's really great at handling it and playing stuff in strides. So it'll be interesting to see. These negative ads have started, you know, less than a month out. They're really coming at her hard. We'll see how she handles it. I don't see them being a factor. It's just my gut reaction based on what they're going after her on. And I don't see much substance to it. It's a comment here or there, nothing that I think is fatal.
It really seems like just with the diversity of neighborhoods and municipalities that it's going to be the ground game that's going to decide. And look, we all, you know, have ways of tuning out the television commercials. All right, so let's pivot to a completely different landscape, which is the open Connor Lamb race, as Congressman Lamb is running for the Senate. So obviously the lines have been rejiggered, but give folks a sense of the communities we're talking about, and then we can talk about this race.
So you have three main defining areas. You have the Alley-Kiske Valley where I live. This is a, you know, like I said, working class mill town along a river, very classic Western Pennsylvania. And you have the North Hills of Allegheny County. The North Hills is this sort of interesting mirage for Democrats because it consistently goes Republican. But because it's a wealthy suburban area, there's sort of this idea that it's going to be like the Philly suburbs and it's going to start steering left. There's been no data to show that. But Democrats keep running at it looking for water and end up drinking the sand. So it's always fascinating to see how people, the Democratic Party, mythologizes the North Hills with absolutely no data to substantiate it. So it's interesting how that works. And then you have Beaver County. And Beaver County has some old steel mills. You know, the old J&L was there. You still have some steel going on there. You have a working class community. This is on the Ohio River. So, it is very conservative. And we have lost it. There's no doubt about it. In the past few elections, it's been bleeding and bleeding to the point that it has gone to the other side. So it is a red county. But it is a place that if you message right and talk to working class people, you can scrape off votes.
Well, I'd just make a shameless plug and encourage listeners to tune in. Memory serves me, last summer, we sat down with the mayor of Aliquippa and had a...
Dawn Walker.
Yeah, we had a fascinating conversation about just in really 3 decades, how much has changed. Yeah. And I believe that Beaver County still on paper has more registered Democrats, but performance, as you mentioned, is a completely different. Well,
that's the bulk of Western Pennsylvania these days is you see these significant registration advantages. And when you talk to people that don't understand the long red thread, they don't understand the blue bleed to red. They say, well, you know, this is a solid, you know, slam dunk for us. No, it's not. You know, that district is a registration of D2, and it performed what, R3? So it's tough. It's a very swing district, and it's really hard to get people to understand. Like my old house district where I live, which is the Alley-Kiske Valley, which is in this district, before redistricting, it was a 27-point D registration with a 7% performance. That's a 20-point swing for Democrats. That is a hostile district and very, very dramatic. And the slightest misquote, misstep, it's gone on you. It doesn't take much.
Okay, so give listeners a sense who's duking it out in the primary up there in the North Hills and in the Alley-Kiske Valley and
Yeah, so you have the front runner is Chris DeLuzio, and he is a veteran, Annapolis attorney. He's, you know, his family's been part of the Democratic infrastructure for a long time. He's gotten the county party endorsement, the AFL-CIO endorsement. He's raised, you know, $450,000, his cash on hand's at about $156,000. And he's widely regarded as the front runner on every measure that we look in a race: money, muscle, support. And then you have Sean Malloy, who was a big player in the DNC, worked under Congressman Doyle, and did a lot for the gay activism of the Victory Fund. And he got the Young Democrats of Allegheny County endorsement. His money has him at about $207,000 raised with $74,000 cash on hand. So you do see a clear front runner and a very establishment, methodical, systematic campaign with Chris DeLuzio. Sean's done more of sort of a grassroots activist campaign, but that's really hard to do when you're talking about 700,000 voters. That's a really difficult sized race to work on activists and door knocking, especially when you have very rural areas like Beaver County and like parts of the Valley and the North Hills. If you're going to rely on door knocking in those areas in a district with 700,000 people, you're really going to struggle.
So give folks a sense, because I imagine the themes and the policy areas are somewhat different between these two congressional races. I mean, what is the soundbite? What is the stump speech? I mean, is it focused on healthcare, for example? Is it focused on jobs and inflation? What's on voters' minds, I guess, versus what's on the politicians' minds?
Well, what's interesting is these two candidates are running in my district, and I haven't actually been able to see them stump very much because we're still in sort of a post-COVID environment. So you haven't been able to see as much as you would have liked. But in the little bit that I have seen, and based on their websites, you've seen DeLuzio with a really solid jobs. He's even been critical publicly about some of the missteps that the party makes, talking about, well, we'll just retrain workers, which has been statistically proven to be an epic failure and just plain bad messaging. And I've seen him actually come out and say, yeah, because we're going to, you know, just, you know, teach them to code. And so he's really done the good working class message that you need to win a district like this. And really how Biden won, you know, infrastructure, jobs. And yeah, you're going to have to start diving a little into inflation and gas prices, but the bulk of it is really jobs because the amount that we're bleeding. And with the supply chain issues, and that's a great opportunity that Chris has done nicely on. You know, our inflation rate is partially due to severe supply chain issues because so much of our products are made overseas. He's been able to capture into that too, how important Made in America and Made in the USA is in a district like this where we are losing jobs. Sean Malloy's done a very classic progressive message. You know, he's talking about activism. He's talking about more diverse representation in Congress. That's at least what I've seen of his campaign. So again, the progressive and sort of the establishment working class D in one district battling it out.
So I don't want to give any sort of free air time to the Republican side of the ledger, but unlike the previous open Doyle seat, this is not necessarily a slam dunk for the Democrats in November. So give folks a little preview of what's happening on the other side and what we should anticipate in the summer and the fall.
Sure. And you are correct. Both the Cook Report and the Crystal Ball have this district as a straight toss up. They're not giving it one way or the other. So you have three candidates running on the Republican side. You have Kathy Koder, when I looked at her finance report, there wasn't one. So I can't tell you what she's done on money. She ran for lieutenant.
Well, we have a lot of listeners in Washington. So if anyone works for the Federal Election Commission, tune in.
Yeah.
All right. So who else?
I didn't see one. She ran for LG in 18, got 22%. And then we have Jeremy Schaefer, who actually ran to be my state senator in 2018. He lost that race by only like 700 votes. And it's because the couple wards in the city, his opponent really just annihilated him there. He didn't do any work there or even try. On the other end, his opponent did very badly in the AK Valley. So he has decided to go at it again. He's independently wealthy. He has $678,000 he's raised with $614 cash. And he has run a very just sort of cultural attack on the socialist Democrats, you know, that classic DC messaging that they do against any Democrat that runs. And then you have Jason Kilmeyer. Now, Jason is he's a writer that's done some journalism. He also works as a consultant on military safety for Deloitte Global. This is classic military industrial complex stuff. He's got an interesting background. From any perspective of a regular voter, it's fascinating. He's only raised $120,000 with $110,000 cash, but I think he's going to be an interesting contrast to Jeremy Schaefer, who just goes hard right and does some real culture war kind of stuff. Jason actually has an argument that is he's trying to appeal to a more security focused part of the Republican Party and more pragmatic on the journalistic end. So he's an interesting candidate for Western Pennsylvania, not something I would have expected. So it'll be interesting to see how that primary works out with Jeremy beating him on fundraising so much, but him sort of pulling it a little to the center for the Republican Party. And I don't know if he's really messaging there, but it certainly looks like it. So that race is fascinating to me. I'm interested to see who comes out on top on that one.
Well, Aaron, you've been super generous with your time. As we wind down, the umbrella that's hanging over all of this are the Senate candidates and whatever turnout operation they're going to have. Yeah. And then the gubernatorial candidates on the Republican side, where you have more than I can count.
I don't have that many hands, fingers, and toes.
Exactly. So we got Congressman Lamb and we got Lieutenant Governor Fetterman, and they both call Allegheny County home. So is it a safe assumption that they're focusing a lot of time and effort on getting, is that their base? And if so, how do you think that overlays with these congressional campaigns?
Well, so first of all, you have Malcolm Kenyatta in the race, who's been an impressive candidate. He hasn't done as well in fundraising, but he's also from the Southeast, and that's 50% of the vote in the state. You really can't discount the fact that Philadelphia and the suburbs and collar counties of it constitute 50% of the vote, and that matters. So if you have Connor and Fetterman duking out in Allegheny County and then scraping off the rest, but you have Kenyatta really killing it there, I mean, there's an argument to be made. I don't know if it's a very viable one at this point, because John is just killing it on fundraising. He's been talking to low information voters since January. And I always say, if you have a statewide candidate whose name recognition is 100% to the point they can talk to low information voters in January, like, pack it up, because it's going to be really hard to penetrate beyond that. I think that, I mean, John is 30 points up in the polls, so it's very easy to assume that he's going to be the nominee unless anything significant happens. And he's got a great grassroots effort. He's got donors giving him $27, like a rapid fire ITM. And I think he will have a nice ground game if he's the nominee. And like I said, it's pretty easy to make that assumption at this point, barring anything catastrophic. Josh Shapiro is going to be our nominee for governor. He has no opposition. He runs a classic systematic campaign by the book. I mean, it's textbook. So hopefully he and the Senate candidates will be doing enough to pull this ticket up. Historically, when you have a gubernatorial race in the primary, it tanks the rest of the district. It makes it very difficult for them to really grab on, and because the life is being sucked out of what is happening.
Yeah. And for better or worse, in Pennsylvania, the gubernatorial candidates don't have any giving limits. So they have budgets, which are extraordinary. Well, you know what? Before we end, just give folks a one little snapshot of another Allegheny County resident, potentially the next lieutenant governor of the Commonwealth. Yeah. He also has a primary, but Austin Davis.
Yeah, he's running against Brian Sims. Two great candidates. Austin's obviously endorsed by the gubernatorial campaign, so he's got a lot of money coming in there, a lot of labor support. But Brian Sims is definitely fighting. He's putting out a good message. He's on the air, so we'll see how that goes. It looks like Austin's got that, but I wouldn't count Brian out. He's a very captivating and charismatic candidate.
Okay. Well, Aaron, thank you so much. We are going to have to see where everything, where all the chips land, but this is going to be a fascinating, with lots of twists and turns, a few weeks ahead.
Absolutely.
Alrighty. Thank you.
Absolutely, Ari. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in to a special episode of Pennsylvania Kitchen Table Politics. Please join us for future episodes by subscribing. And while you're at it, give us a rating and a review. We love listener feedback, so drop us a note via our website, papoliticspodcast.org.
And a very special thanks to Jake Schwartz for all his production assistance. I'm Ari Middleman, and this is Pennsylvania Kitchen Table Politics.